Live from the soapily beautific hills of Encino, California, where industry and nature work hand in hand to create a better life for all of us. The following program is produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. Welcome to True Crime Uncensored. I am the legendary Burl Bear, Mark C.G. Boyer. Fact checker is here.
Hello.
Howard Lapidus is with Don Waldman on the island of hiatus.
Oh, he's hanging out with his son.
He's getting to have a baseball game, I think. I spent a lot of time in Las Vegas. You know, I used to live in Las Vegas, live in what they called Naked City. Now, they called it Naked City because back in the old days, that's where the showgirls used to recline out there on Naturella juice.
I thought it was because I was running down Las Vegas Boulevard naked.
Yeah, well, you were, no doubt, I'm sure. There are police in Las Vegas. I've interacted with them on more than one occasion as they pulled me over for such crimes as we saw you leaving that particular apartment complex where I happen to live. Why were you there? I live there. Well, you shouldn't go there. We have someone who knows a lot about Las Vegas police. Deborah Gauthier, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
That's correct, Burl.
That's amazing. See, I usually just perform French and not speak it, so I'm proud of myself. You know what it's like to be in the Las Vegas Police Department. One thing, you have a brand new book out called Bright Lights, Dark Places, which is a fascinating and informative book, not only about personal transformation, but how to put up with a whole bunch of BS that I can't imagine how you ever put up with.
Well, we put up with you, Burl.
Well, that's true. This woman went to the police academy. Now, years ago, I was talking to Mike Grimes, who was head of a homicide task force of Anchorage, and he said, all different professions have a code of ethics. He says, except police, we have no ethics. We have no code. But yet, when she went to the academy, and I have this in front of me, she had to assign or, recite this code of ethics. And I just want to quote a little bit of it to you and our beloved audience. As a law enforcement officer, my fundamental duty is to serve mankind, to safeguard lives and property, to protect the innocent against deception, the weak against oppression or intimidation, and the peaceful against violence or disorder, and to respect the constitutional rights of all men to liberty, equality, and justice. And if I know something confidential, I'll keep my big mouth shut. Was there any relationship between this code of ethics and what you experienced as a police officer?
Oh, my gosh. that's what I think was so shocking to me, because I really took that code very, very serious. I mean, we swore an oath to office. We raised our right hand. It was actually performed in one of the judicial offices. By the county clerk. And I took that as exactly what it said, that I was going to be doing. That was the ideals that I was going to be working under. And, I was fresh out of college, so I thought...
Oh, you were a dewy-eyed sociological virgin.
Pretty much so, yes. So it was shocking that everything that I went through was opposed to that code of ethics. And the bad guys, I discovered, were not on the street.
Where are your
colleagues? But oftentimes were... in the department working with me. So.
Now, we had a guest a couple of weeks ago whose sole purpose of joining the police force was to facilitate his criminal activities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wow. He's known as the most popular corrupt cop in America. I gave him that title.
Right.
But it is a shock. I've had another police officer that I interviewed for one of my books say, the reason I wear a bulletproof vest is the front is for the guys on the street, the bulletproof in the back is to protect me from the other cops.
Good point, yes.
So,
yes.
And you still are, according to all our research, a female.
Correct, that's true.
And this was unusual at the time, was it not?
It was. Back in 1980 when I joined the department, the year before they had a height and weight requirement prior to 1980. So you had, I think it was like 5'8", 175. That was the minimum standard. So, obviously that would have eliminated me. I'm about 5'2"-ish and maybe 110 pounds at the time. So the somebody had filed a complaint with the Department of Justice, and that was lifted. And I came in the very next year and was hired under the same standards as a man.
So, there was resentment against you sexual prejudice against you, prejudice, the minute your cute little frame sallied forth through the door.
That is so true. And I had no idea that being the first one under those standards as a pioneer would cost, it came with a price, it would ultimately cost me everything.
Yeah, try walking into a schoolroom down in Alabama in 1964.
Oh, right?
Same sort of thing. Except you didn't have people out in front yelling at you when you walked in.
Right, right.
But when you got in there, how long did it take you to find out that you weren't exactly getting the welcome wagon?
Oh my gosh, it started in the academy. You know, I was getting ripped from the recruits. You know, I remember the first, we had an orientation the first day before the academy actually started, and they were issuing our equipment, and they had the guns, you know, our weapons and all the stuff that we were going to use, the tools of our trade, and they had the sergeant came in with his staff, all these, you know, flat top guys, it looked like, you know, DIs in the military. Anyway, they came in and started yelling. One of the exercises was to break down our weapon and reassemble it because we were going to be having inspections every morning. So they did this drill, showed us how to disassemble the weapon. It was a semi-automatic. Now, I was familiar with guns. My dad was military, Burl, but it was mostly long guns.
Yeah, like M1s, you know, rifles or stuff like that?
Yeah, yeah. So
did you ever lose a thumb taking apart an M1?
Right? So you're like a revolver, but this is a semi-automatic. So when he called Tom, we had to reassemble the weapon in 2 minutes or less. And so he hit the stopwatch, and, you know, I was scrambling around trying to get it all together. Well, I didn't make the time. Well, it was like, you could have heard a pin drop. The guy walks over there, the sergeant starts grabbing my long hair, it was down to my waist, screaming in yellow profanities of what's she going to do, you know, out there on the street, and his hair better be cut off by Monday morning. And anyway, long story short, when I went out to the firearms range to shoot, man, I was second in shooting in my class out of 50 guys, including myself. So, you know, it has nothing to do with size, obviously. It's just finesse and skill when you're dealing with weapons like that. But yeah, it started there. I mean, they were not friendly then in the academy. They gave me hell. And then when I got out on the street, you know, it was more. I could never prove myself enough.
How was your training officer at the time?
I had four training officers. I'll tell you what, they were old school guys. They were probably the most senior guys on the squads. Good news is they didn't really want me there, but they tolerated me. But the really good news is they were really good cops. So I really learned some good skills from these guys.
Excellent.
And they were advanced skills, like putting together search warrants and cases, you know. So they taught me a lot, but I had to put up with their stuff, if you know what I mean.
Right.
But they gave me a fair shot. I mean, they ranked me on, they rated me on how I performed, which I was very grateful for.
Yeah, they could have really messed with you worse if they wanted to.
Yeah, right.
We're on the internet, so you can just be yourself. You don't have to.
Well, she is herself, and she's charming, even with her short hair.
You don't have to hide behind euphemisms.
No, I'm not hiding.
She's not hiding. She's well-spoken. Speaking of well-spoken, even in training, you had to deal with dildos. No, I'm sorry to say.
I beg your pardon?
Well,
sign up for this training?
No. One day, one of her fellow recruits forgot his weapon on the bench.
Yeah.
And what did they do to this poor guy?
That poor guy. He was another. I mean, we were all right out of college. I mean, this guy, you know, he was wet behind the ears, too. But he forgot his weapon, walked out to inspection with an empty holster.
Uh-oh.
And they just tore this kid up. So the next day, he had to come out and carry a dildo for a week. That was his weapon, and he had to carry this thing in his holster during inspection and during the whole entire day. I mean, but you can imagine, he was
humiliated.
It was,
I'm sure
it was humiliating for him. I was embarrassed for him. It was embarrassing to me. And then, you know, during the inspection, these guys that were sitting, you know, other recruits sitting, standing in inspection with me, decide to grab the dildo out of his holster, start rubbing my leg and making all these vulgar noises.
Sounds like outlaw radio.
Right. So it was crazy, but yeah, that was the environment I worked. That was before, you know, hostile work environment.
Yes, I would have filed a case on that one.
Yeah.
But then you get out of training and you go to the real deal.
Yeah.
What's Black Hand Day?
Oh my gosh. That was a phrase they coined in the academy when they were going to wash out a recruit. So a black hand would literally drop down on this one-way mirrored window from the academy staff's office. It would drop down in the window, so we knew that day somebody was going to wash out. And then they would march in, the training officers would march in, the TAC officers we called them, with a big aquarium that housed Dr. Doom, which was a huge boa constrictor.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and then behind them was one of the other TAC officers carried a cage full of mice, and there were the same number of mice as recruits when we started with 50 mice.
Gee, I wonder if this is a metaphor.
I don't know, but you know what I'm saying? They would literally get one of these little tiny mice out of the cage, drop it into the aquarium with Dr. Doom, and then we'd have to sit there and watch with sweat running down our face this little mouse jumping up and down, freaking out in the cage, you know, because this Dr. Doom was now on the move, stalking this little mouse to kill it. And that represented one of us. We had no idea who it was. And after this whole ordeal, and when Dr. Doom had the little mouse down in its throat, the TAC officers would then come in and snatch someone's unsuspecting rookie's, you know, books and things off his desk and command him to follow him out. And then they were washed out of the academy. We lost. We started with 50 recruits, Burl. We only graduated 21 Metro officers. We washed out over 50% of the class.
That's almost like law school.
Paper chase. Here
yeah.
We go.
Right?
Yeah, they're going to wash you out.
Yeah.
Well, so then you actually go to the Las Vegas Police Department.
Correct.
And if you thought it was fun in training.
Oh, boy.
Now, how long were you there before you were offered the wonderful position of, what do they call it, community relations or whatever it was called?
Community Relations Bureau. I was there 17 years.
And how long were you in Las Vegas PD before you got that position?
17 years. I did 21 years on the police.
Oh, okay. I thought it was early. Cause whatever department it was where you went there, where it was just a mess. The budget was screwed up.
Yes.
The floor was filthy. No one knew what they were doing. Whoever had it before was running their business out of there.
Correct.
But we got 17 years to cover before that.
Yeah,
survived 17 years of the old boys network.
Yes.
I mean, they were even hanging dildos from your locker.
Yeah. Yeah, that happened after an incident with one of the rookies that I was working with. Actually, it wasn't a rookie. It was an officer that I was working with downtown. Now, downtown in the old days was underneath City Hall. Mm-hmm. That was our downtown station.
Right.
I'm unfortunately familiar with this location.
You are?
Can you explain?
Well, there may have been a period of time where a friend of mine may have gone to the Four Queens or the Mint or the Nugget and gambled underage.
Now, some friend of yours.
I wouldn't condone this activity.
Yes.
And that was where the jail was, so yeah, you would know that place.
His friend would.
Yeah. His friend would know.
Yeah, his
no,
friend would know the place, would. Yeah. Right. Wait a second. You had a couple in those intervening 17 years before you got to that wonderful position. You almost got killed a few times on the street.
Correct.
Tell the story about the guy who comes at you with the car.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's probably one of my closest calls. We responded to a domestic violence. It was out in kind of a rural area just south of the Las Vegas Strip. So it's out there, you know, in more of a rural community.
Right.
We went out there on this call, and Metro, our police department, we work solo. So we don't have two-man units other than training units and any special assignments. So we work by ourselves. But anyway, I went on this call, and my backup finally arrived. We went in, handled the domestic violence, and I was coming out. I had parked my car along just on the dirt shoulder of this road in front of the house. And it was like it was a really narrow road because it was out there. There was no street lights, just a real rural area. And as I was getting in my car, I look ahead and I see these headlights coming down the street towards me at a high rate of speed.
Uh-oh.
And as I'm watching, the dust is flying up. I can see it from the headlights. As this truck, this vehicle swerving back and forth in the lane. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, drunk driver. And I had already turned on my car, my headlights, and I was. This is all happening in a split second. I have to decide now. Okay, this is a drunk. He's headed right for me. Do I get out of the car or do I get out, stay in the car, and hope for the best? Well, he's approaching, and I mean, this is seconds. I hear my partner. Deb, look out! Great, right? He's still with the couple in front of their house on the porch. As this vehicle comes right up to me, I dove out of my car last minute, and it was like a chicken wire fence, like a real thin fence around this guy's property, and I pressed against it. It was just enough room between me and my car for this vehicle, which was a huge, it was like a Ford pickup. It came around the corner. It dodged my vehicle, you know, avoiding my headlights, and went literally between me and the car. And oof. It came through me, and it hit my. I braced myself for the impact because I thought I'm gone. This is it. Game over, because the headlights are right at me, and I'm just pressed against the fence. There's nowhere to go. It's all happening so fast. The guy was going like 70 miles an hour.
Jeez.
Well, anyway, he hits my arm with the side view mirror on this big truck, just about dragged me off the fence, and heads down, doesn't even brake, and heads down the road like nothing happened. Well, he took my car door off. He just literally ripped the car door off my car. Well, what do I do? I do what any rookie would do. I jumped in my car. I spun the car around. I turned my red lights and siren. I chased this guy without a door. A door, yeah. And so all you hear on the radio is, you know, I'm screaming on top of my lungs, and the wind's flying through.
Yeah.
You can't hear anything I'm saying. And they're just going, oh my gosh, what's going on? And I'm chasing these guys. And when I actually chased them, caught up to them, was going to give the plate, and then they blacked out, went out into the desert, and eventually our helicopter unit came out into the desert and found these guys, and we took them into custody.
I bet they faced a variety of exciting charges, not to mention damage to your vehicle.
Well, he was on parole. He was just out of prison.
He was homesick.
Right, and he was on drugs and alcohol, so the guy was just, he was just in the zone, and I mean, that was probably the closest call I've been in some other tight situations, but that was probably the... I don't think I slept for 3 days.
Oh, God, no, you probably had nightmares about flying car doors.
I do. I still get a little alarmed when I'm on a dark street and I see headlights coming down the road.
Now, being as you're a diminutive female, shall we say.
Yes.
Lithe and lovely. You're in a situation where you're arresting a guy who's enormous. I mean, his arms are bigger than your thighs. Not that you pause to measure them, but
right.
But this guy is big, and there's a warning on him that he fights officers, that he will put up a fight.
Correct.
And yet, when you go up to him, what happens?
Well, that was another call. It was a car stop, actually. No tags on the... no license plate, no tags on the vehicle. So I pull him down, don't know what I'm walking up into. And those are scary when you're an officer, because usually you can do a run on the plates and kind of have an idea what you're dealing with. But for this guy, I was walking in cold. And when I got him out of the vehicle, he was this big black guy. And I knew he'd been in prison because he was all buff. And I'm just thinking, oh, this is not looking good. But anyway, I ran him, and he comes back. The dispatcher came back. He's a wanted subject for armed robbery.
Oh, boy.
So I'm thinking, oh, great. And he's looking at me. He's on the hood of my car. I've got him out of the car. And he knows now that I know he's wanted. So at that point, you cannot ever show fear when you're on the street. And I'm not very big. And it's all a matter of it's tactics, it's strategy. You've got to work really smart when you're my size, obviously. But you can never show any fear. Now, I could have backed off, called back up, and, you know, hope for the best. But this guy was sizing me up, and I'm thinking, you know what? I need to go home at night. So what I did was I walked around to this guy, and I kind of called his bluff. I go, you know, hey, I'm out here by myself, just a little concerned. I just make sure everything's cool. I'm just going to check you real quick. Just kind of called his bluff, and I did a speed cuffing technique on him, and he was in cuffs, like, really fast, and he was as surprised as I was, and he just looks at me. I said, you're under arrest for armed robbery, and he said, yes. He goes, yes, ma'am, which I was surprised. He called me ma'am. So I put him in my car, and back in the day, we didn't have cages.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy sat literally right in the passenger seat next to me, and I had him all strapped in. And as I'm walking around the corner to get back in my police car and wiping my sweaty hands on my uniform pants, I get in beside this guy, and I'm looking at him, and I said, hey, I have a question for you. The dispatcher said that you had a flag on you, a caution that you would fight officers if arrested. I said, why didn't you fight me? And he just looked at me and he said, ma'am, this is the first time I've been to jail without a beating.
Woo.
Yeah.
Wow, that gives you an insight into what he had experienced at the hands of the police department. We're going to take a 60-second break. We'll be right back with Deborah Gauthier, author of the new book, Bright Lights, Dark Places. 60 seconds.
If you own an iPhone or ride the plastic pony in front of Kroger, you are no longer tied to your computer. You are now free to roam and take Outlaw Radio with you everywhere you go. Grab an Outlaw Radio iPhone application, the smoking, drinking, interrupting. Did I say interrupting? 24-hour party that you follow now follows you. Your iPhone is now the easiest way to stay connected with your friends at Outlaw Radio, like me. Change the way you listen to the radio 7 days a week, now available at the iTunes App Store.
Back to True Crime Uncensored with Burl Bear and Howard Lapidus.
He's not here.
Featuring Mark C.G.
Boyer. He's here.
Boyer.
I'm here.
And sometimes Maureen.
Who isn't here?
Becky Esquire.
She's buxom.
Produced by Magic Matthew Allen.
He's not.
He's not.
Who in turn is produced by Lori Downey Jr.
He's hot. All right, are we back to True Crime Uncensored with the legendary Burl Bear, Mark Boyer, and Deborah Gauthier, author of the new book, Bright Lights, Dark Places, available now from Tate Publishing. Is that correct?
Correct. And I'm on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get it anywhere books are sold.
And they should get several copies. They make wonderful holiday gifts.
Absolutely.
Now, let's get back to this beating business. Here, this guy says the first time he's ever been taken to jail without getting beat up first.
Yeah.
Well, then we move on to the next story in your book, and we find that you got somebody and the cops decided to beat him up right then in front of you.
Yeah, that was really unfortunate. You know, I was working swing shift. We worked 3 p.m. to 1 a.m., and then the graveyard guys would come in after us, and there was a little bit of overlap there. They'd come in about 11. Anyway, there was a graveyard squad out there that we actually called the Black Glove Squad.
Oh, boy.
Because they were known for excessive violent force against people. So that guy, one of those guys came to back me up. I had a kid on my hood of my car that was he was under arrest. And one of those
guys, 16-year-old kid on a stolen vehicle?
Yeah, that's the story. Yeah, and one of the officers from that Black Glove Squad came to back me up. And as he walked out, got out of his car, walked up, didn't even talk to me, just came up and said something to the kid and then punched him in the face.
Ooh.
And I'm looking at him like, what are you doing? He goes, I'm teaching him a lesson. And I,
what lesson is this?
Yeah, right? And his cheeks swelling. The kid's got, you know, terror in his eyes. And I'm just thinking, what's this about? So, I told the guy, I said, look, you lay hands on him, he's yours. You take him to jail. And the guy, he just looked at me and he goes, he just ignores me, gets in his car and takes off. So I called his sergeant and I said, look, here's what happened. So I was ordered to take the kid to the hospital. And, you know, you know, back then, if you said anything, you were a snitch.
Yeah.
I mean, they would make your life hell. And I got that label early on because I didn't play like the boys. And not all the guys were like this. Hear me out. I mean, we got some great men and women that do police work across this nation that deserve our support and our respect because they have a very tough job. But I'm talking about the few renegades out there that make it bad for all of us.
Well, when you went to get on the SWAT team,
oh yeah,
I got the book right in front of me. It says your sergeant Tom calls you in and says you came in number two. I was really pulling for you in there. He added, yeah. While I was defending you and challenging their concerns about having a woman on the SWAT team, the commander burst out and said, "I'm not having any niggers or broads on my SWAT team."
Yeah.
That kind of ended the discussion.
That's correct. Yeah, he outranked my Sergeant Tom, and he was a great guy. He was my first sergeant. He was on my oral board for when I tested for police department. So this guy, he was 6'6", gentle giant, I called him. He was just a great guy and really rallied behind me. And had it not for Tom, I probably wouldn't have made it through that first year of training. I would have quit because it was so intense what I was going through. And the stress in itself just becoming a police officer, you know, learning the ropes, working the street and all that tension there. But then what I was going through internally and not having the support and not having the backing, not knowing if I would have a backup when I went on calls.
Why wouldn't you have backup? I mean, you're a police officer. If you call in for backup, they should send it, shouldn't they?
Well, they should, unless they don't want to, they don't like you.
Oh, that's so, a problem.
Right? So, you know, and I kind of got that, you know, I had an incident when I was, gosh, right out of training, you know, when I first got that assignment downtown. It was a very senior squad, and I had one of the officers start stalking me on calls and just doing some really sexually things towards me, you know, pressing against me and just harassing me. And I told him to knock it off, but he would never knock it off. And he was caught actually pulling one of his little things with his lieutenant. He actually saw this guy, you know, doing his thing with me. So, and I mean, you know, rubbing up against me.
Well, they say you ought to file a complaint.
Yeah, he ordered me to file the complaint. I'm like,
but if you do that, you're doomed.
Yeah, because you file a complaint, you're done. And this guy forced me. He was a lieutenant. He ordered my sergeant to order me to sign this complaint against the guy because he didn't like the guy. He wanted to get rid of the cop, which, you know, I didn't want to be a part of. So
you're putting yourself in a real bad situation there.
Oh, bad. And after that incident and all his buddies rallied behind him and all of a sudden here's a girl cop, you know, causing problems and filing complaints. They didn't care that I didn't file. It was a lieutenant. They didn't care about any of that. And after that, I mean, they made my life miserable. I mean, every time I got on the radio, Burl, they would click the mic so they would cover my radio transmission. So, I mean, if I were out there making a car stop, they would click when I was giving my location so nobody knew where I was.
Oh, wonderful.
I was going on calls. Even if they were assigned my backup, they would conveniently come really late. In other words, they would delay backup so that I'd go on calls. I mean, work in the Naked City was all gang turf back then. It was Mari Litos. And I'd go on fight calls by myself. I mean, it was, you know who alerted me to what was going on? My African-American brothers. They came up to me because they'd already been through all the nonsense.
Oh, yeah, because I mean, if this guy's saying, I don't want any niggers or broads on my SWAT team, the black guys already know what the atmosphere is.
Right, and so they come up to me and they go, girl, you're on your own out here. And we're gonna go watch your back a little bit, but we can't let anyone know we're doing this because they've already threatened us. But you're rolling out here by yourself. Your back's uncovered. I'm thinking, oh, great. But, you know, they'd already been through it, and they go, just, you know what, just suck it up. Just weather it. It'll pass if you just let them know you're not going to quit.
Well, you had to hang in there a hell of a long time.
Yeah.
I mean,
I was still hanging in there at the end, right?
I mean, this would have broken a lot of people. I mean, they would have just said, I'd rather go work at the 7-Eleven serving up big gulps and put up with this crap.
And wait for the midnight robbery.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was intense. You know, but back in the day, I mean, that was, you know, when I raised my right hand and took that oath, I said, you know what, I'm going to do this. I made an oath. I made a vow, and I said, this is what I'm meant to do, and I'm going to do it. And I had, and you know what? I knew that I was paving the way for other women. So if they got rid of me, if they took me out, it would affect women behind me for years. And it did. Even to this day, we still have a very small number of women in law enforcement. And it is sad because they've even done studies that as departments bring on more women, hire more women, and even out their force, you've got less use of force complaints, less liability, less, you know, money defending lawsuits.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know they can sue the city when the cops do weird stuff.
Correct.
And it amazes me. And I have talked to cops who've told me or bragged about all sorts of horrible illegal stuff they did. And I said, well, doesn't anyone file a complaint? I said, well, the city carries insurance for that. We don't even pay attention.
Correct.
And that's scary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you worked my stomping ground, Naked City.
I did.
I was just in Naked City.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I was
and
just
you
there.
Were in Las Vegas, too.
Yeah, well, when I first moved to Las Vegas, I went there to do a project for the Nevada Historical Society that didn't actually wind up working out and got a surprise divorce at the same time and wound up on the street.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was taken in, not in a negative sense, but in a positive sense, by the stereotypical hooker with a heart of gold who said, you can stay at my place. Never did sleep with her, which is probably smart, but we became good friends. In fact, I have an interview with her up on the Internet, former cracko, as we say. telling about her adventures in Naked City. And as she says, I spent 2 years working on a book that I lost everything that I did my research on because it was all stolen, called Shadow of the Stratosphere. And she said that as long as I can look up and see the stratosphere, I know who I am and what I am, living in the shadow of the Strat there in Naked City. And it's a whole little, it's almost like, what do you call it? What do you call that? My mind just went blank. Where you let things slide a bit. You know, where you have an area where you know everybody's doing stuff that's illegal, but you can't arrest everybody. There won't be anybody living there anymore.
Right.
And so you just kind of, you know, harass a few people. The last time she was arrested and went to jail was for not having a light on her bicycle.
Oh, boy.
I don't think they do that to most people. And as they arrest, she said, I haven't been arrested in anything for 2 years since I cleaned up my act. Why are you taking me to jail for a bicycle light now? You know, this isn't 5 years ago when I was working the street.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess once you're on the list.
Yes.
You probably had some fun times in Naked City.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it was crazy. You know, that was right after Carter let all the Marilitos into our country.
Uh-huh.
And those Cuban Marilitos were all living in that area behind the stratosphere.
Right.
So it was intense. And, you know, I have a few stories.
Yeah, well, you talk about the fact that some of the Sangrenistas, is that what it's called, Mark? The South Central American and Cuban religious thing with the...
Oh, no, that's Santeria.
Santeria,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's, if you're not used to that, that can kind of shock you.
It is. You know, I walked in on... We went in on a call. It was a burglary call, and the back window was open on this apartment, so my partner and I went around and we ended up making entry and called a code red. We went into this apartment, crawled inside, and inside the apartment, this is one of these Cubans' apartments, they had fish hooks, like fish netting, like a fish net, all throughout the apartment, like on the walls, on the ceilings, and then they had fish hooks on each of the corners of this you know, big netting, really. And so there was all tape, it was all tacked onto the walls. And when we went in there, I'm just thinking, what the heck? And I've got my flashlight walking around this apartment, and my partner gets caught up in this stuff. He gets pinned against the wall. I considered leaving him there, but then I decided I would cut the guy out, you know, out of the netting. So, but it was weird. You know, they had these altars, and then they would usually kill, like, an animal. They would sacrifice an animal to their gods, and they would usually...
It's a bizarre mix of Catholicism and old
Buddhism,
tribal...
Yeah.
Serpent and the rainbow.
Yep, saw that.
Yeah, it's some weird stuff. You know, they would have, like, a chicken hanging from a door frame with a spear through the chicken. It was alive, and it was killed alive. But it was just a really weird culture. And, you know, and then, of course, they didn't speak English. So, you know, I had one, you'll like this because there, a lot of the showgirls, you were saying a lot of the cocktail waitresses lived back in those apartments because they would walk to the strip to go to work. And we had one of these guys terrorizing the neighborhood. We had a series of rapes, violent rapes, where this guy, the guy, his MO was he would follow these gals home, and when they would get ready, put their key in their apartment door to go inside, he would violently push them into the apartment and violently sexually assault them, rob them, and leave on foot. So he lived somewhere in the area, but one night, and he had done, I don't know, probably 15 to 20 of these things, and we were looking for him. He was on our hot sheet, our sheet that we get every night with all the crimes, and we were, you know, I was trying to put a pattern, okay, when's the guy hit, what day is he most prone to, you know, I was trying to strategize when this guy would hit. But I kind of would hang in that area during the times that he would usually hit these gals. And it was when they were getting off work. And I was on patrol, and sure enough, here comes the code red beep on the radio. And it was a sexual assault that had just occurred in the area. And I was right around the corner.
Ah.
And I said, okay, where's this guy going to go? He's on foot. We knew he was on foot. And I blacked out my police car, went in an alleyway, like just adjacent to the apartment complex where this gal lived. And here, I look up the, you know, at the end of the alleyway, and here comes a silhouette of a man running down the alley. I'm like,
uh-huh.
Oh, it's him! And I mean, I threw my red lights and, you know, everything on, my lights on, my headlights, high beams, And I rushed at this guy, and I mean, I slid within inches of him, and he's just standing there like deer in the headlight, and I jump out of the car, draw down on the guy with, you know, get him on gunpoint. And turns out they brought the gal. This gal was, she was the only one, the reason we got him is because she was the only one that had enough composure to dial 911. The other gals would, you know, call a friend or, you know, they'd be freaking out. But and by the time we got the call, it was like, it was a cold call and the guy was gone.
Right.
But this gal immediately called 911, and that's why it was within seconds, minutes after the actual crime that I caught this guy right in that alleyway. So, and sure enough, he was a Cuban Marilito, and she came by, identified him, and then we did him on, probably just about all the other, with excepting maybe one or two other sexual assaults, these gals all identified him in a lineup. And you know the sad thing, Burl, was we never went to court on this guy.
Oh.
Because he was a Marilito. They just shipped him back to Miami.
They didn't ship him back.
There was no justice, and these gals were ruined.
This guy
brutally beat them and raped them. I mean, they were just...
Wow, if he was from out of the country, why didn't they send him back to Cuba?
Well, because we had that whole thing going on, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
here
I remember,
in our country, you know.
I remember that I interviewed the guy who brought the first Cuban gang to Las Vegas.
Oh, really? Wow.
Louis. He's still there, and he's very reputable now.
Uh-huh.
But I had some incredible stuff from him. Sadly, all the interviews I did with the guy about the first Cuban gang to Las Vegas, a lot of other these people that, you know, won't talk to cops, won't talk to attorneys, they'll talk to me.
That's perfect.
And sadly, everything I had was in an apartment. The apartment was broken into. I had everything on backup disk, but my computer was stolen and all the backup disks were stolen.
Mm-hmm.
All I have left is the prologue, which I had wisely emailed to somebody. So, yeah, this is before there were clouds and I didn't have the brains to like send it to myself on Yahoo Mail.
Right.
So I've been trying to get to redo the interviews because I was... mentioned what years were you? Was this? We're talking about the 80s, the 90s. What time period are you working that area of Naked City?
Oh, the Naked City. I was on the department from 80 to 2001. So those were my first probably 4 or 5 years on the department. So 19, probably 82 or 81 through 85.
Yeah.
In 85, I was promoted to sergeant.
Now, next week on the show, we have Dr. Scott Bond again, who was formerly vice president of NBC and then went on to become a sociologist and criminologist. And in his book, Moral Panic, which was his doctoral thesis, actually, when he explains moral panic, he gives Las Vegas as an example. He says, if you interview people in Las Vegas, they believe that gang crime, Latino gang crime, was up like 400% in the 1980s. And the cops got 13 new cars and a gang interdiction unit. And yet, if you look at the actual crime statistics, there was 3% of the crimes were Latino gangs, 3% of the drugs before, during, and after the moral panic. There was no crime increase, but it certainly worked well for the cops to get 13 new cars.
Right.
And that was how we defined where you have a situation where someone benefits in the power structure, the audience, the newspaper readers or people who watch TV are given scary information all of a sudden for a short period of time, and they get some resolution passed or some budget increase, and then...
Well, just look at the increase helped.
Increase what?
The increase helped.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, crime's down.
Yeah. See, it worked.
Now. It worked.
It's back down to 3%.
You know, I took out elephant insurance.
Did you?
Haven't been attacked by one elephant since.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I bet that's a fascinating study.
Yeah, it is. You can, this is called Moral Panic by Dr. Scott Bond, and he has all the documentation in there, and he uses that in order to instruct the readers on what moral panic is by giving an example before he gets into his major thesis, where he studied the sociological concept of moral panic as it relates to America's entering the Iraq War.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which was a fascinating study, and he's an interesting guy, and he'll be on next week again because he's just so much fun.
So your career is despite all of this, moving forward. You make sergeant.
Yes.
And then, it starts to fall apart. What happened?
Well, I started moving up the ranks. That's what happened. you know, and it's
well, that's not
started,
good. Don't you know your place?
Right. You know, I made sergeant relatively quick in 5 years. It took me 9 years to make lieutenant. I kept conveniently coming at the bottom of the list.
Amazing.
And, you know, it's because I'm really good at leadership, and I knew there was, you know, they needed balance in the workforce, and I had a perspective that the men didn't have, so they needed me in there, but they didn't want me in there. So what happened was, as I moved up the ranks, some of the good old boys that I had run-ins with were moving up the ranks either with me or they were ahead of me. And, you know, it was just a matter of time. They weren't going to have any of me up in those ranks. And when I was about, I made lieutenant finally, when one of my African-American lieutenant decides to pull the plug at the last minute because he had had enough, and he actually pulled the plug a little early for retirement. He'd been on like 36 years. The guy's, you know, he'd been there for the long haul. He's one of the early black officers on the police department. But anyway, he had gone through his mess, and he just said, I've had enough. And one day he was driving home, he called me, and he said, hey, I'm retiring. You can have my bars. Because I was sitting number one on the list, and they, when there's an opening, they can't just pass you over. So they had to promote me to lieutenant. And when they did, oh my gosh, I paid for that. I paid for that promotion. And, you know, I went ahead and just, and you can read about the stories in my book. I mean, you'll see just the adversity. I mean, and it just, the opposition increased, it seemed, the higher I went in the ranks. And when I was about to be a captain, they had an outside assessment team come in and run our assessment center. And so it was unbiased. The sheriff had no say in who they ranked and how they ranked, because they went strictly on the performance of all of the components of the assessment center. I came out number one, hands down. And the sheriff at the time told a briefing room full of men that I found out later, as long as he was a sheriff, I would never be a captain.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it took him, within a year, he had one of his boys start covertly recording my conversations, and that was when I was a bureau commander, and set me up on a bogus discrimination charge, like I'm discriminating against a white male officer, right, a sergeant. And that set the tone for retaliation. He got me on tape saying, at the end of a day, when I was just enough of his stuff, and he was harassing me, but he was recording the whole thing, it was just all a setup. And he had me on tape saying, hey, Chuck, I've had enough of your stuff. If you don't like it, you can transfer. They said that was retaliation because he filed a discrimination.
Meanwhile, you're going through eight times as much crap.
Correct. And you know what? I lost two ranks. I not only was not promoted to captain, I was demoted back to a sergeant. Listen to this. Assigned graveyard, and my call sign, I am not kidding you, was 666.
I think that's a subtle hint they didn't like you.
I think so.
Well, you know, I don't like getting too biblical or chronicle. Is there such a word?
I don't
know. I know that one.
But the sacred scriptures of the world's diverse religions have been my hobby for over 40 years.
Wow.
And I had posted on Facebook one the other day that from the Quran where it said, do you really think, I'm really paraphrasing it now because I don't want to dig my Quran out of my bag, which is in the other room. Do you really think that you could go on behaving like this, being mean to people, being cruel, not helping the poor, abusing the downtrodden, and you're going to get something good out of this?
Yeah.
You know, we'll let you do this for a little while. We'll let you run rampant with it. But you're not going to get any, you know, when it's all said and done, you go, oh my God, I wasted my life.
Correct.
And there's a very similar quote in Romans that's in your book where it says, God quit bothering them and let them run loose. It's all the exact same words. That all hell broke loose. Rampant evil, grabbing and grasping, vicious backstabbing, made life hell on earth. Envy, wanton killing, bickering and cheating. Look at them, mean-spirited, venomous, forked tongue, bullies, swaggerers, insufferable windbags. Sounds like a lineup of our cast here on Outlaw Radio.
Exactly.
And, you know, the world is full of people, and yet, and these same people quite often will just say they're religious as can be.
Right.
And I figure somewhere in heaven, Jesus is vomiting.
So, did you have a police union?
We did. We had a police union, yes.
And did you make any effort to fight your demotions?
Oh, my gosh, of course. Yeah, I had a union lawyer take the case to court or before the board. And even they said, you know, this is a witch hunt. I mean, it was ridiculous. But there was, you know, their board with citizens, you know, in the community that were handpicked. So, I mean, the odds were just stacked against me. And even with the union behind me, because they were like, you know, we got to, she's part of the union. We have to fight for her. You know, they couldn't fight this thing because it was so, you know, it was coming from the head. It was coming from the sheriff. So I lost that case, and then when I filed a lawsuit, similar to what you were talking about, Burl, my attorney got spooked when they broke into his office. Now, we don't know who they are, right? But mysteriously, his office is broken into, and all the documentation pertaining to my case is all rifled through.
Isn't that a strange coincidence?
Right? So he got spooked, and then he backed off my case. He didn't fight it anymore. He was like just a lame lawyer on the case because he didn't want to. He was afraid. I mean,
oh, yeah, forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Right? It was sad, you know, and I called Gloria Allred. I said, Gloria, you need to come here to Vegas and take my case. This is crazy. You know, she had just done the tailhook scandal with that naval officer,
right.
Female officer, and she, you know, she walked away with a good chunk of money. Well, as soon as I told her I was in Las Vegas, she goes, good luck.
Good luck.
I'm like, great.
Yeah, I could have told you.
Right.
You know, ask someone who's been on the other side. They'll tell you.
So, exactly.
So how far from this point do you have left? How many years did you stay?
I did 21 years. So
no,
the last,
from this
when
incident.
They demoted me two ranks, I did the last 4 years on patrol as a sergeant, and I wasn't. My call sign was not 666. The union did step up to the plate and goes, you know what, this is total harassment, uncalled for. This is a senior. She was a senior sergeant then. She's a senior sergeant now, and her call sign is 509. So I had just a regular squad of officers. And you know what? I just got back to basics again, having fun out on the street with the guys, you know, raising up guys that I thought would be good leaders. And here's what I tell the guys. Can I share this, guys? Because this is really powerful with this book.
Sure.
You know, I wrote this book out of my pain initially, It felt good to write it, but that's not the book that you're reading, because I put that book away for a while I got healed up, because I didn't want to be bashing people. We don't need any more of that. I rewrote the book out of my passion, because I wanted my book to make a difference, not only in people's lives, but in our community and in law enforcement in general. And now I have guys that I tease all these guys, because I said, you know, a lot of these guys now that were my enemies are my friends on Facebook. And they're all like, hey, Lieutenant, they call me LT. LT, am I in your book? And I said, well, buy my book and read my book.
You're in the part about the windbag.
But anyway, these guys are now, you know, a lot of them have come to my book signing, and I've reconnected with a lot of the guys. And, you know, I can't tell you how many of these guys have come up to me. And a lot of times it's over coffee in private, but they're looking at me with tears in their eyes. And now they're feeling the pain of the injustice.
Right.
In fact, now they understand what they put me through, because before it was just one of the boy games and they were just part of the group.
That's why you can't harbor all that pain and resentment.
Right.
Because not only does it poison you, it keeps the door shut for them coming to you and asking for, you know, in Judaism, there's two kinds of forgiveness you ask for. Those that you have to ask the person to forgive you.
And we're coming up on this.
Yeah, that's right. Yippee Yom Kippur is coming up.
Yippee-kippee.
Yep. Yippee-kippee. One where you have to ask the person to forgive you. You can't say, God, forgive me. You have to go to the person and say, will you please forgive me?
Yes.
And you go three times. After three times, if they won't forgive you after three times, that's their problem. Then there's the things where you ask God to forgive you.
Well, you missed one. After you have asked for and received forgiveness from all those you've grieved, you have to forgive yourself for what you've done.
That's a good
And then you can ask God for absolution.
Wow!
But when you don't, then that door is shut.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a book called The Power of Forgiveness that came out probably about 15, 20 years ago. And it has this, you know, you've seen that picture of that young girl, the Vietnamese or Cambodian girl running, and she's been hit by napalm.
Oh, yeah.
That terrifying, horrifying picture.
Yes.
The guy who dropped that napalm on her sought her out.
Oh, my gosh.
And apologized to her, and she forgave him. and they went together and gave talks.
Wow.
On the power of forgiveness. And as forgiveness is very, very powerful. And if you hold on to that stuff, those resentments and anger and refuse to forgive, you don't have to forget. But people do change. People do get transformed. Yes. They'll have a turnabout of the deepest seat of consciousness. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite ones, and I talked to Bill Wasmuth. He's passed away now. He was the fellow, the Coalition Against Malicious Harassment. He was in Hayden Lake, Idaho, and the neo-Nazis bombed his church, tried to kill him.
Yeah.
And we were chatting one night, and he said, you know, you can't reason with these people. You can't sit down and try to reason them out of their extreme prejudice against Jews, blacks, and even everybody else that they hate and despise. What happens to make a difference is they will suddenly have a turnabout at the deepest seat of consciousness. Something usually connected with love will snap them. And this one particular guy, he's sitting there, and he wasn't raised this way. His parents couldn't figure out why he was such a wacko. But his kids came in the room and said, Dad, Mom won't let us watch TV anymore because she says there's too many niggers on TV. And all of a sudden, bam, goes, what the hell have I done to my kids?
Wow.
And he picked up the phone and called his parents and said, what do I do now? And they had him call the Wiesenthal Center here in Los Angeles, Museum of Tolerance. And he travels around, and he still has all the swastika tattoos and crap all over him, but he gives talks on how he got out of that wacko stuff. But it always is something that touches their heart, their soul, their spirit, whatever you want to call it, that causes the change. You can't, just like Captain Crunch says about sharks, you can't reason with them.
There was a really fine film, American History X. You have to watch the director's cut, the one that the studios didn't hack to pieces.
Yeah.
And it's that story.
Yeah, it's a fabulous one. It's amazing. Because people do change.
Absolutely.
I have had people apologize to me. There was a guy that used to throw garbage at me. I mean, I'll like this story. We got enough time to tell it. I think you'll get a kick out of it. When I was in high school, there was this group of guys who were just biggest jerks on the planet. I mean, they could have won Guinness Book of World Records, biggest jerks. And me being a Jewish kid, and they would throw garbage at me, call me dirty Jew, blah, 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 all this horrible stuff. So when I graduated high school, one of the great joys was knowing I would never have to see these guys again. 20 years later, I went back to my hometown, and I'm also a member of the Baha'i faith. There was a Baha'i prayer thing that night, and I went to it, and it was candlelight. And I got in a little bit late, and I sat down, and people were having prayers, you know, interreligious prayers and stuff. And they blew out the candles and turned on the lights, and I'm face to face with this guy that used to throw garbage at me.
Oh, my gosh.
And my initial response was to come across the table and throttle him. And I just looked. I mean, it was so such cognitive dissonance to see this guy at a praying for the unity of diverse races and religions that all people get along. And I looked at him and I said, how long has it been since you changed? He said, about 10 years. He says, and I knew someday I would see you and I would apologize to you.
Wow.
And so he did, but I still hadn't forgiven him. Inside, I still wanted to throttle this guy. So I said to myself, I got to invite this guy over to my house for lunch and serve him with my own hands.
Wow.
To get over this. So I did.
So how much strychnine?
Well, just enough. So we'll hear the end of the story. So he comes over to my house the next day. We have lunch. We sit outside. We talk for several hours. He gets up to leave. I shake his hand. Glad we got this all resolved. But I'm still feeling a little something, right? And then he says, now I got to save the best for last. He said, God has a great sense of humor. He says, I married a Jewish girl. I said, well, that's your punishment.
See there? That's a great story, Burl.
That's a true story.
Yeah,
so
perfect.
People do change. There
yes,
are,
they do.
There are, what do you do for a living now? Or do you get a pension?
Very small. Because I was terminated from 21 years as an officer. And I wasn't 50 years of age because we have an age. Even though I had 21 years in, I didn't have the age requirement, which was 50. So I was penalized 2.5% per year, and there was 7 years. I was only 43 when they terminated my employment. So, yeah, I took a really big hit on my pension, a very small pension, hoping my book does well. And what do you think? Do you think this will be a good movie, you guys?
Yeah, I think so.
I think it would be a great movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like G.I. Jane.
I think, yeah,
no,
exactly. Yeah,
I don't think we're going to get Demi Moore to play you.
No, well, she's too old to play
she's,
now.
She's too
tall.
Jessica Alba.
Sandra Bullock.
Too old.
Too big.
Too old, yeah.
Too old, too tall. No, Jessica Alba, maybe. Anyway, we've run out of time. The book is Bright Lights, Dark Places.
Yes.
It's fascinating, informative, and spiritual all at the same time. And so it's a good combination of ingredients similar to a doctor's prescription. And you, of course, have earned the official Outlaw Radio True Crime Uncensored title of Crime Hottie, which is...
Wow.
That's Aaron Moriarty has that title, too, so you're in good company. Thanks so much for being on the show, and I'll let you know when it's up in the archives. You can listen to it, all right?
Perfect. Thanks, Burl.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care, you guys.
You bet. Great guest, good book. Next week, it's the 15th, right, or something like that? Yeah. Dr. Scott Bond returns, the media guy turned criminologist and sociologist. We got a good lineup this month.
And sociopath.
Well, that's us. We're the sociopaths. He's the sociologist. Magic Matt Allen and the demons, decadence, including Mark and myself. Ralphie is here. Hiya, Ralphie. Stand up. Oh, he is. Hi, Ralphie. It's good to see you. Let's get retro. Play the hits. Now, Laura.